Welcome to the Zevo Rebel podcast. This is your host, Talia Herring, and this is the episode where we rebel against the trashy habits that have brought us towards climate change. In today's episode, I'm really excited and honored and a little bit nervous to be speaking with member of the Knesset and longtime environmental activist. Wow, you can really hear my nerves. Alon Tal, who grew up in North Carolina and has since moved to Israel and has been nonstop establishing the most amazing environmental organizations, including the Israel Union for Environmental Defense, aka Adam Tov Vadin, which might sound familiar to you guys listening in from previous episodes, the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies, and the Green Movement. He ran in the last election and is now part of the Knesset, which is really exciting as an American citizen. And now you're on the Committee for the Impact of the Environment and Climate on Public Health. So I'm so, so excited for you to be here. I am number one fan as an American Olah, as a law school graduate, as a past young Judean, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with you. You're an inspiration to me as someone who moved to Israel and has had such an impact while being here. And I would love to hear some of your reasons of how you made Aliyah and what was that decision and have they shifted in the last 40 years?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind introduction, Talia. And I'm glad that the torch has been passed and there's a new and young generation of rebels and people who are impatient for environmental change and transformation. Well, how was it that I came from a pretty good life in North Carolina to find myself in Israel? Well, I think basically as growing up in a family that had a strong Jewish identity and a strong Zionist identity, it became clear to me at a very young age that it would be unimaginable that I would live at a time when the so-called Third Jewish Commonwealth was taking place, that this miraculous, rising from the dust of the Jewish people to reclaim their status as indigenous people in their own homeland would take place and I wouldn't be a part of it. I mean, I always just say if I had two chances to go through with it, I probably would have gone on and got an MBA and gone to Wall Street, maybe hopefully made a little money. But you don't have dress rehearsals, and this was really just seemed to be the most compelling way to spend my life. And thus far, I feel that decision made when I was very, very young has been validated by subsequent experience.
Yeah. Has that changed throughout the years? I've been here for 10 years. And sometimes I really think, what was that decision back in the past? And now, you continue to make the decision as you continue to live here, as you continue to take more responsibilities and joining the Knesset, you had to rescind your American citizenship. How did that feel on a personal level?
Well, I think first of all, in terms of how do I feel, 40 years in on this decision, I think when I first came to Israel, I might have had a vague sense of having missed out on the historic opportunity that my parents had, or even my grandparents, that they were the so-called Palmach generation that were privileged to be able to create this astonishing state. And now we've come along and really the heroic stuff has been done. But as I became more and more engaged in environmental activism here, I realized that that was not true at all, that it was just the opposite. That we, and including you, Talia, are the blessed generation, that it's the next 10 years which really are going to determine what kind of a land of Israel we leave for future generations, whether it will, manage to conserve some of the iconic landscapes and the extraordinary biodiversity that we inherited, will we be able to create a quality of life and stability and sustainable way of looking at the world that our children can take forward and really have a good life here. And it's really, I think, decisions that are made now. So I feel like in terms of being able to make a contribution, one thing I'll say about Israel, which has not changed since I came here, is that when I came here, what I liked about the country so much is that it wasn't ossified, is that you could, as an individual, hang up a shingle and start an organization or open up a podcast in your case and really do your own thing and maybe make a real difference if you were, but it was a meritocracy and in that sense, I think Israel remains a very, very exciting place. And I have no regrets about throwing my lot in with the Jewish state at all.
I love that. And does it ever feel frustrating? Like you've been in this field for so long and still seeing the delays and, climate change is getting stronger and stronger and we're seeing the effects. Does that ever throw you off? You're like, what's the point? Is it too late?
I am constantly frustrated that I'm not doing enough. Things aren't moving fast enough. I mean, I think that any of us who see the data and read the projections about what's going to happen on this planet and where the trends are going need to be alarmed. I mean, this is not a time for complacency. So in that sense, yes, of course, I feel frustrated on the macro level. As a member of Knesset, I feel that I've worked very hard in the last 8 or 9 months. I mean, really put in many, many hours, mostly 15, 16-hour days, 6 days a week. And the truth of the matter is that if I evaluate so far how I feel I've done, I've been very successful in some ways and not in others, and I'll be specific. In public policy, we make a distinction between outputs and outcomes, okay? Output is something you do, when an outcome is something that actually happens or changes. So I think I've been very, very good at creating outputs and submitting laws and running committee hearings. We started this committee and 37 environmental campaigns locally. We accompany them and champion them. But in terms of outcomes, I mean, we have had a few successes, but not nearly enough. And I'm hopeful that we'll do better. Mm-hmm. I think that's just that's the responsibility of anybody who's an elected official to always feel that they need to be dissatisfied with the pace of change and the level of progress.
What are the challenges that you face when pushing for those policy changes, especially as an OLE, or maybe that doesn't come into play here, just as an environmentalist pushing against, you know, budgets and all these other aspects in creating policy?
Well, I don't feel that my ethnic origins or my, you know, community affiliation as an American immigrant have at all hindered me. I think that people have a general positive feeling towards America and positive feeling towards me. But yes, I feel that there is a culture of government here, which I had a general sense of prior to coming to Knesset, but now it's quite acute, that there's a lot of interests, not economic interests, institutional interests. So, for example, when you bring up a law, you need to have 5 or 6 ministries sign on, and especially with this government of change, which has such a razor-thin majority, the rules of the game are you have to have consensus before you can push laws forward. And consensus means that the last, you know, most, I don't know, trivial bureaucrat in a government ministry can stymie critical decisions, and ministers can do it as well. So I feel like that I have to figure out a little better how to get beyond that. One of my answers is to really work more within my party. I have wonderful support from the blue and white party. I'm sort of insane. The blue, white, and green side of that particular party. And every time I've said, I need you to back me up, Benny Gantz and my comrades in arms from the blue and white party have been there for me. And I think I need to rely on that more because, you know, we need, when we work as a faction, we're much more effective.
Absolutely. Is it educational aspect in getting support for these bills, or is it kind of meeting people where it's relevant for them? How do you have these conversations with other Knesset members?
Well, it is an educational thing. For the most part, you want to convince people and you go to committees and try to bring people over your way of thinking. I'll give you an example. The last week of the Knesset, the government passed a decision which presumably will lead to the closing of all the petrochemical industries in Haifa. This is historic beyond dimension. Since the 1930s, when the British Mandate opened up the oil refineries, the people of Haifa have had to endure really, really toxic environmental conditions, air quality and the like. And it's manifested in abysmal health statistics and indicators. You know, the city of Kiryat Chaim, if you're 60 or over, you have a 17 times greater chance of having cancer than not. If you go to this one street called Degania Olive Street, there's not an apartment there where there's not people sick with cancer or have been, or, you know, many died and some have been cured. So when you have that situation, you have to be able to convey that. And indeed, we as a faction, first I brought people out of, I said, when I became in the Knesset environmentally, it seemed to me that according to the environmental management principle, worst things first, I had to focus on Haifa, which I did. And then when this decision came up, I was dissatisfied because it was a very important decision, but it wasn't enough. For example, the large and expansive park along the Kishon River is being held up by the Israel Ports Company, a government corporation who wants to take those lands for logistical centers and put containers on there. And I'm very grateful that in the, you know, when the cabinet met, my ministerial representatives came out strong against it. And I think we'll be able to change that. And we're putting a lot of pressure on the Ministry of Transportation to step in and intervene. And there are areas where we make a big difference. So yeah, but that comes through largely convincing people that there's real problems, but there are also real solutions.
How do you know when the solution is enough? Like the gray area of, you know, progress, but not perfect enough, because there's never going to be the perfect 100% solution. You know, damage has already been done. There's other interests involved. And anytime you start a new law, you're also breaking down and there's other consequences at play as well. How do you find that when pushing for policy?
Talia, you know, it's always been axiomatic for me that perfection is the enemy of the good. And, you know, politics is the art of the possible. I'll give you an example. We submitted a bill which was, we've done three things. There's something called a class action suit. Class action suits are legal actions, civil actions, when a large number of people are affected, but maybe not by so much. So none of them, say everybody has to 1,000 shekels of damage. So none of them have actually a sufficient economic interest in filing suits. But collectively, if you put all those 1,000 shekels together, it's a ton of money. And so usually lawyers go about and do that. And we felt that this law was being perhaps utilized by some opportunistic lawyers, but the environmental organizations who should be talking about these kind of things don't have the standing they want. So we made a law that gave them standing. We also wanted to give greater flexibility to judges to make the kind of creative decisions and provide money. So we had three things in there. And the Ministry of Justice was, we went all the way up to the Deputy Attorney General, and she said, no, we like the first thing. We're willing to accept the first thing about giving the environmental organization standing. But this other aspect about the judges, we want them to give all the monies into certain funds. We did not succeed. Rather than fight and fight and fight, I said, let's pass the first time. And now on Sunday, the Knesset committee will pass it on to the Constitution Committee of the Knesset, because you have to have three readings, and that takes a while. The first one and the second, third are done together. And I'm hopeful that the chair of the Constitution Committee, Rabbi Gilad Kariv, who's a close colleague and friend, former rabbi, a very brilliant man, will know how to shepherd that law into something better. But even if not, I'll take the victory on the environment organizations, and we'll live to fight another day on the other ones.
That's fair. Yeah, it makes sense. Also, you're in the long-term game. You have to, you know, keep positive energy and keep going with it. I also just, okay, I know we're talking about realistic expectations and policy, but I'm really curious to hear, what does your utopia look like if you could flip a switch and have everything perfect the way that you expect, or not expect, but would dream of, for the ideal reality of Israel in terms of environmental protection? What would it look like to you?
In my ideal world, we'd start with a stable population with two children per family. So that when you have that stability, then you can start addressing problems. I would create ecological corridors, which would connect together all of the nature reserves and maybe really provide a chance for the remarkable species that we're so lucky to share this country with could actually survive. I would be very, very happy if we took public resources and invested them significantly in making public transportation faster, more efficient, more reliable than the private vehicles, and get people out of their cars. I would probably put really high taxes on beef and other meat so that people would do the right thing in terms of their diet, right thing for the planet, right things for animal welfare, clean air, clean water. There's a lot of things I'd do.
That sounds cool. The last episode of this podcast was with Rabbi Akiva Gersh, who talks about veganism, how there's a Jewish basis for veganism. We talked a lot about that, about how Jewish values come hand in hand when it comes to respecting the planet and our bodies. And I really see that in the language that you use when it comes to the environment. There's a lot of spirituality in the underlying language of how you view our relationship to Israel and that Zionism, but also just respecting our planet and our society here. And I think that's really cool to see how it all connects.
Yeah, you know, I've always felt that Judaism and environmentalism are fundamentally synonymous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously if you look for passages in the Bible or in the Talmud, you'll find things which might make you raise an eyebrow, but they're basically anomalous. Read the book of Genesis and you see there, it's basically a it's a story of sustainability. You know, you mentioned veganism. Well, that's what was Adam and Eve were living in harmony with nature, and they didn't eat meat. It was only Noah who, you know, after the flood, could start eating animals. And then Noah's Ark, which is such a grand allegory or for biodiversity.
Totally.
Or the perils of, you know, technology run amok with the Tower of Babel, carrying capacity with Abraham's fighting, battling with Lot's shepherds. Just everywhere you learn, there are environmental messages and wisdom there that we would be well to listen to.
So why do you think it's less of a conversation in religious communities?
That's a really good question. I would think that when you could argue that in some communities, it's a question of hierarchy of needs. If you know Maslow's theory of hierarchy of needs, that their economic conditions there don't allow them to do that. But I would think mostly it has something to do with the tragic paralysis of the Orthodox community, inability to evolve and to integrate the best of modern values with the best of traditional Jewish values. And this incredible fear that any kind of change would lead to the destruction of Judaism. We know that all religions and all species need to evolve, and the world is changing, and it would be well if they would take on some of these messages. The good news is I think that there is a growing commitment to the environment inside of the Orthodox world, the ultra-Orthodox world as well. And I'll give you an example. Shakuf is a Israeli website/news agency. Anyway, they did a survey of what Israeli parliamentarians feel about climate change and who believes in it and whatever. And they started the article off with a quote from Simcha Rotman, who's a member of Knesset, a lawyer from the religious Zionists, you know, the Tzionut HaDatit party. And he basically said, who's sure even if there is climate change? And if there is climate change, the only thing we can do is pray. So I went to the chairman of the party, to Bezalel Smotrich, and I said, Bezalel, I have my disagreements with religious Zionism, but I always assume that you guys were not anti-science, you know, and I would like to make a proposal. You don't have to decide now, but I would like to suggest that I bring you 3 or 4 of the top climate experts from academia. That's where I come from. I'm a professor. And they'll put the facts in front of them and make whatever decision you want and decide about it. I said, but you don't have to decide. He said, no, I already decided we're going to do this. And then I saw him just the day before yesterday, and we're talking about setting up a small symposium now for the press so they can really get the facts. So,
wait, it's happening?
Yeah, we're going to do this. Not in front of cameras, not for newspapers, but because Bezalel Smotrich genuinely wants to do the right thing as a very observant Jew. So I'm hopeful that as he becomes more acquainted with the perilous situation of our planet and the implications of a more than 1.5 degree temperature rise, that he will indeed bring his party's policies into line with environmental sanity. I'm confident he will. So I think that's really the job we have, is to those communities that are not with the program yet, don't be dismissive and don't mock them, work with them and try to give them the germane and important information they need to form the right conclusions.
Okay, cool. That actually leads me to another question I want to ask you. How can someone gain the confidence to step into the role of an environmental advocate? Because if someone comes and they don't have a degree in environmental science, or they're not up on all of the policy changes, or they might have just one understanding of what climate change is, how can they feel comfortable to still talk about it with their friends and their parents and their coworkers? How can they feel they can widen the understanding and advocate for environmental change?
Read. It's not rocket science. I mean, when I went to see my PhD at Harvard, I was complaining to my father that I hadn't gotten my undergraduate degree in chemistry and organic chemistry. And he said, my father's a PhD chemist and research chemist. He said, you don't really need that much chemistry. You probably have enough chemistry from what you're, freshman year in college to do everything you need to do and know about the environment. Most of this information is highly accessible. We are so fortunate to live in an age where we have internet. And so if somebody really has a good intuition, but feels that they lack sort of the empirical data or just the depth, that's fine. We're all like that. I mean, I recent years, I became, all of a sudden engaged with the energy issue. I'd never taken a course in energy. When I was in graduate school, I took a course in every environmental topic conceivable, except for things like sewage treatment. Then I dealt with sewage treatment for the next 5 years. The world is dynamic, and you just have to be sufficiently nimble intellectually to be willing to tackle these issues, but don't cut corners. You know, read the books. There's books to be read. It's not just a question of a Wikipedia article. Mm-hmm. We have the tendency, you watch a TED talk and you all of a sudden you're some sort of expert. No, it doesn't work like that. You have to be more, a little more thorough if you want to do the right thing by the planet.
Any recommendations of books and resources?
Oh, yes. Well, if you want to read climate change books, the best book I've read on climate change this year was a book by Bill Gates called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, a book which is largely a technology book. There's another book which I would recommend called Taming the Sun. That came out in 2020 from he's a brilliant guy. He's an engineer, basically, a PhD from MIT, and then he was an advisor too. And then that's a wonderful, if you want to know just about everything you want to know about solar energy. Those are good books for climate change. And of course, there's always good books coming on, but we somehow, you know, academics now minimize the significance of books and always try to focus on academic articles. And I say, no, the great thing about, and I've written, I guess, 7 books and edited 4. The great thing about books, I say, it's like playing tennis with the nets down. You can really say what you want to say without being, you know, locked into a very, very narrow framework that academic articles tend to, you know, force you into.
Yeah. And there's a lot more depth, I think, like to connect to not just the research behind something, but the story behind it and the cause and effect, not just cause effect, period. This is the research. Good recommendation. Thank you so much. And I want to ask you also, where do you see Israel and our role in Israel in the fight for climate, you know, to mitigate climate change? What is Israel as a small country? What can we do? And where is our role? And also, question number 2 in that is, what about Jews in diaspora? How can they connect Israel with their environmental advocacy?
Well, I think the first thing you have to realize is get rid of this, a graduate student of mine I called exceptionalist attitude in Israel. Oh, we're so small, it doesn't really make a difference. That's the same kind of thing as saying, oh, if I don't pay my taxes, I'm so minimal in the national, you know, revenues, who's even going to notice, you know? So why should I even do that? Well, that's an immorally bankrupt position. The fact of the matter is that whether Israel's large or small, the entire international community realizes the planet is sick, and they're all rallying to get under the proverbial stretcher. And all of a sudden, it's inconceivable the Jewish state would say, well, in this most paramount of ecological challenges, we're going to opt out. We need to be under that stretcher, doing our part in carrying this, you know, beleaguered planet to health and to safety. So we really need to do our part. So that's the first thing in terms of, and that we all know what we need to do. We need to move to 100% renewables. We need to move to electric vehicles. We have to get to 90% recycling. Right now, we're just 20% in that country. The list goes on and on, but we know that what needs to be done. It's been known for a couple of decades. Some countries are starting to do it. I mean, Denmark's at 67% renewables, okay? Why isn't Israel? Just a question of political will. Now, with regards to what our sisters and brothers in Jewish communities in the world can do, well, there's a lot you can do. You know, think globally, act locally. So, you know, make sure if you're involved with the synagogue, make sure that it's a no net emissions synagogue. Have, you know, solar panels on the roof and make sure that your environmental performance institutionally is first rate. Get involved in your local environmental work. If it's with an NGO, and I would strongly suggest you get involved in politics. If you're passionate about environmental education, run for the school board. You know, if you care about, I don't know, sustainable traffic, you know, get involved in that area. There's so much that you can do as an individual once you decide that you're want to be part of the solution and not the problem.
I mean, you're a politician, so it makes sense to say, again, involved in politics. But why do you think politics is the way to make the biggest change? You were also a professor. Like, why did that impact more people?
I ran many environmental organizations. I've seen all different. I often feel like it's, you know, all these civil society, it's very important and makes a contribution, but it's like the fly trying to move the elephant. I'd rather try to be riding the elephant. And I'll give you an example. When we have in Israel a development project, which we think is going to be disastrous and will destroy, you know, important in ecological assets or beautiful places that we want to preserve. So you can try to file objections as an environmental organization, or you can write an article against it as an academic. And maybe you can delay it at the courts, whatever. But at the end of the day, the only way you're ever going to stop that project is with a political decision by a planning commission, which is usually a city council or something like that, or a regional council, which is represented, has representatives from government agencies that are run by politicians. The only way you're going to do it is through a political decision. And that's maybe the way it should be. In other words, that's democracy. We want the people to make these decisions. We don't want an elite group of NGO leaders or nonprofit zealots. We want to be able to do this, you know, based on what the most people want. And so if you care about this stuff, then you need to bring the people with you. That's the only real sustainable solution. And you see what they've done in Germany, and that's a good example of the kind of thing where a Green Party started and changed the entire political map for that country than Europe. So yeah, I believe that politics does matter. And certainly now that I'm about 9 months into my new career as a politician, I'm more convinced than ever that to bust out of the glass ceiling, which constrains environmental organizations, it's really going to help me through politics. And more people should do it. If we had, you know, another 30 or 40 people like me in the Knesset, we'd be in a very different place.
So any advice to help people get involved in politics?
Well, there's a distinction between national politics and local politics. Local politics, it's totally a possibility for you to declare independent list, be a Green Party. We've had Green Parties that ran people who became deputy mayors in Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and really brought their green agendas there. So that's an easier answer. At the national level, there's a debate, would we have room in Israel for a Green Party at the national level? And of course, I once was felt strong that we did, and I helped establish the Green Movement, which was a Green Party. But the trouble is when Israel has such a extremely high threshold, if you don't get 3.25 votes percent of the vote, which is about 4 seats of the Knesset, you're not going to be able to serve at all. And Israelis are so afraid that they don't want to be considered to be suckers. They are not willing to vote for parties that are not convinced they're going to cross that 3.25% threshold that you need to get into the Knesset. In other words, 1% is not enough. And that's basically what we got at the Green Movement. So it's a big challenge. So then to me, the logical outcome, having reached the conclusion that once they pumped up the so-called, you know, minimum threshold for election to the parliament, that it meant you have to find a party and find a way to become a member of parliament without necessarily, you know, giving up your being a green champion. And lucky for me, blue and white, new party. I happened to know the chair. It was my commanding officer when I was in the paratroopers. And I was very fortunate that he retained confidence in me and pointed me to his list. And you find in many parties sort of green champions. And that's great that so many parties have brought members of Knesset who are environmentally passionate, but we still need more.
How does it work with everyone that's in different parties working on the same goals? And does that shift, you know, there's so many different points of view when it comes to renewable energy or, you know, waste management. How do all the people that are like on the same team still voice their opinions and their own agendas when they come together to the Knesset floor?
Well, the conventional wisdom would be that if, you know, studies suggest that as many as 200,000 or 300,000 Israelis will vote for a party within a realm based on its environmental positions. In other words, it's not my only issue, but if I can't decide between Yesh Atid and blue and white, if I can't decide between labor and merits, if one of them is the environmental superior party, that might sway my vote, okay? And this constituency and the power of the environmental movement has really motivated environmental candidates in different parties or get parties to say, we want to have an environmentalist in our elect group, you know? So the assumption would be that those of us who are the green representatives in the Knesset are competing in a zero-sum game kind of dynamic. In other words, if I get votes, that means that Yorai Lahav Harzano from Yesh Atid is not going to get votes, or Mussi Elias is not going to get votes, or Sharon Eskel from Yesh Atid. In other words, but the truth of the matter is, once we meet in the Knesset, and I always say green politics is different, rather than see each other as rivals and try to sabotage each other, there has been just a wonderful, I would say, spirit of cooperation, of camaraderie, of helping each other. And individually, I have great affection for my colleagues. And it's a privilege to work with them. I came in and said, I'm probably the only member of Knesset who's going to care about the environment. No, there are others, and we work together, and we play good cop, bad cop with the government sometimes. Sometimes we sponsor legislation together, but we are in it together because the challenges are so great and the stakes of losing are so high. We can't afford the luxury of divisiveness and one-upmanship. We need to be working together, and I'm really, really happy that in the Knesset we are.
That's awesome. That sounds like really powerful. What are your goals moving forward in your role in the Knesset and moving onwards in this career?
Well, I think that we have made a priority in our legislative work, my staff and myself, in looking at the issue of biodiversity. Israel's blessed with extraordinary diversity, 115 mammal species, a couple thousand plant species, half a billion birds fly over Israel every year. It's unbelievable. And yet we had tremendous success in restoring the ecosystems of the country during the country's 50 years, truly an ecological makeover. But the last 20 years or so, largely because of population pressures, the natural world has been taking a hit. And one third of all the vertebrate species are defined as endangered. And so we need to do better. And so those are areas where I've been working on with some, I think, with moderate success. But we hope to have a whole series of laws which will push Israel to even better place in terms of our performance as a conservation-conscious country.
And what happens in conversations when, people are saying, we don't have the budget for that. These are, more important, urgent, tasks we need to handle first. How do you, compete with that?
Well, those are arguments I heard when I first came to Israel, 40 years ago, and maybe it was true back then. But today, Israel is a wealthy society. And I think that we all recognize that even if you're not somebody who believes that, that the gazelles and the hyenas and the ecosystems of Israel have an inherent right to exist because they've been here right here before us. Even if you don't believe that, I think we could convince you on an anthropocentric level that there is a human need to be in touch with nature. They call it biophil. Well, when people are born, you see, how the way children are so tied to their teddy bears. And, all the sports teams have animals as logos. We have this tremendous longing for unity with the natural world. How lonely a planet would be if we were the only creatures here. And so I think that you could really make the case that certainly preserving open spaces, so there might be a few corners of this crowded land where you can sort of escape and enjoy the contemplative solitude and inspiration that nature offers. These are things that people get out of it, ecosystem services, as we call them. And I believe that we can make a compelling case for their preservation.
That's great. So I wanted to ask, how should people get involved and connect with you? Different suggestions of the community. I know you guys have a WhatsApp group, and I follow you on Facebook, and you post lots of great informational posts about updates from the Knesset. But give me more ways of connecting with you for people to...
Okay, well, certainly. Well, thanks for that. I'm glad that you are following us, Ty. And anybody who wants to go onto our Facebook page, I have two. I have a personal one, which is all done in English, and there's the Israeli one, the public one, although we're actually now integrating some English there as well. But that's a good way to be in touch with me. Also, obviously, Twitter and Instagram. I've always felt like even though Israel doesn't have a system of government which involves geographical representation, as an American who grew up with geographical representation, I'll pick my constituents. Thank you very much. So although I may not know exactly who voted for blue and white, I do believe that anybody who's an English speaker and anybody who believes in religious pluralism, I'm representing them. I'm the only American-born member of Knesset. And, my tribe is my tribe, and my job is to represent them. You can certainly get involved with my, if you have a significant amount of time, we always need volunteers to help with logistics, with research, with activism. If you have time and you're a serious person, contact us. We'll vet you out, and assuming you pass the audition, we'll put you to work. We have a lot of our with us.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for joining me today. Most of the conversations on this podcast have been more on a grassroots level, so it's cool to hear from the top down and see what's happening on a national level. I really appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule to sit with us. So if the listeners listening want to share this episode with other people to widen the impact, I would appreciate that. And in the next episode, I'm going to be interviewing Home Biogas, which takes waste and they convert to clean energy. And until then, stay rebellious. Go for it.
On behalf of the green members of Knesset and in general's environmental movement, I just want to salute you, Talia, for stepping up and offering such important information to people. And I wish you many, many thousands of downloads every episode.
So me.
And I love the fact that you define yourself as a rebel, because indeed, we're going to have to rattle the cage and tear a piece out of the power structure if we're going to make things different. And it's not going to come from incremental change, unfortunately. It's going to come from some sort of more of a real revolution. We need rebels, and you're one of them. And God bless you, and keep doing what you're doing.
So Appreciate it. Yeah, it really comes from this call to action, because we grew up with so much that we have to rebel against. We have to unlearn so much, and we have to keep on pushing ourselves into that identity of we are rebelling. We are actively saying no to things and saying yes to other things that we want to implement in our lifestyles and how we vote and how we live our life and how we work. And I really appreciate you sharing more light. And I think people are going to really gain a lot from this conversation.
Thanks so much.